Today is Tuesday, September 7th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, anti-Taliban protests rock Kabul. Plus, U.S. working with Taliban for more flights out of Kabul.
We're holding the Taliban to the commitments that they've made to ensure the free passage and safe travel for anyone who wants to leave Afghanistan, starting with any American citizens who wish to do so.
Also, UN calls for cleaner air for blue skies. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. Taliban gunmen fired in the air on Tuesday to scatter protesters in the Afghan capital of Kabul, witnesses said, as video showed scores of people scurrying to escape volleys of gunfire, although there were no immediate reports of injuries. Hundreds of men and women shouting slogans such as, quote, long live the resistance, unquote, and, quote, death to Pakistan, unquote, marched in the streets to protest the Taliban and what they called interference in Afghanistan's affairs by neighboring Pakistan. On Monday, the Islamist militants had claimed victory in the last region still holding out against their rule, declaring that the capture of the Panjshir Valley completed their takeover and promising to name a new government soon. Sounds of street protests in Kabul. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin on Tuesday praised Qatar for its support during the United States' massive airlift from Afghanistan last month. The two officials spoke Tuesday at a news conference in Doha alongside Qatar's foreign and defense ministers. Blinken said the State Department was working with the Taliban to facilitate additional charter flights for people seeking to leave Afghanistan after American military and diplomatic departure. He said the U.S. had been in contact with the Taliban in recent hours to confirm arrangements. Blinken said the Taliban have given assurances of safe passage for all seeking to leave Afghanistan with proper travel documents. He also said the Taliban is not blocking Americans from flying out of the city of Mazar al-Sharif, but was delaying departures to confirm the passengers have travel documents. Blinken and Austin are in Qatar to thank the Gulf Arab state for its help with the transit of tens of thousands of people evacuated from Afghanistan after the Taliban took control of Kabul on August 15th.
We're holding the Taliban to the commitments that they've made to ensure the free passage and safe travel for anyone who wants to leave Afghanistan, starting with any American citizens who wish to do so, Afghans who worked for us, including the special immigrant visa applicants or visa holders, other Afghans at risk.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. The United States' 20-year war in Afghanistan is finally over. Taliban militants, who still have close ties to Al-Qaeda and other transitional terrorist groups, now control the country. Terrorism experts are studying whether that could end up transforming Afghanistan into a haven for international terrorism again. Patrick Dunleavy, a senior fellow at the Institute Projects in Terrorism, discussed that potential with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshinawi.
The consensus right now of the intelligence community across the board is not if Afghanistan will return to a safe haven for international terrorism, but when. Just recently, I think it was May or June, the United Nations issued a report regarding foreign fighters who were pouring into the area from areas like Syria and Iraq, again, radical Islamic fighters, to Afghanistan. And you have groups such as the Taliban, the Haqqani Network, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, in the Levant, as well as ISIS Khorasan. They all have a significant number of fighters there, and they are not going to sit idle. They will flourish in an Afghanistan ruled by the Taliban.
ISIS-K showed that the terrorist group is still alive and well, and ISIS extended its terrorist activities to ungoverned or fragile areas in the African continent. How could the re-emergence of ISIS-K embolden terrorist groups in Africa?
Well, very simply, inspiration is a great motivator. The Islamic fighters in Africa, both in northern Africa and in the sub-Sahara, will be inspired by what they see as a victory in Afghanistan, and particularly ISIS Khorasan being able to set off a suicide bomb at the Kabul airport just prior to the United States military forces leaving, which killed 13 U.S. servicemen as well as hundreds of Afghani citizens. Groups like ISIS in northern Mozambique, who not too long ago conducted an attack in Palma, where dozens were killed, and also in Tanzania, the Nusrat al-Islam, another al-Qaeda affiliate, al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, they'll be inspired by ISIS's victory, and will see that as a motivator to continue their attacks in Africa.
How could the Biden administration exert pressure on Taliban so that it forms an inclusive government and ensures protection of minorities and counter the emergence and strengthening of terrorist activities inside Afghanistan?
Quite frankly, I don't think they can. I don't think the Biden administration can do with economic pressure what 20 years of the U.S. military and also civilian operators in Afghanistan could not do. To try to change a civilization from an Islamic state into a democracy with Western ideals, such as protecting minorities and women's rights, is counterproductive. Now, if the Biden administration thinks that they will use economic pressure on the central leadership of the Taliban in Kabul, they're forgetting that for the longest period of time, Qatar has provided financial support for the Taliban. So will the Biden administration try to stop the Qatar financial support? Plus the fact that even if the Taliban central leadership does start to move towards the pressure the Biden administration may put onto it, you have to remember that the Taliban has fragmented unity. There are Taliban leaders and field commanders throughout the 30 provinces, so that even if the Taliban Central Leadership Council would start to acquiesce to the U.S. pressure, I don't think those field commanders are going to follow through or take the leadership in Kabul's advice.
That's my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi speaking with Patrick Dunleavy, a senior fellow at the Investigative Project on Terrorism. The United Nations is marking International Day of Clean Air for Blue Skies on Tuesday, with a renewed call on nations to take steps to limit greenhouse gases and other emissions that contribute to climate change. It called for more funding for renewable energy to improve air quality, blamed for millions of preventable respiratory deaths worldwide. For more, I spoke with VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
This was designated 2 years ago, and it's also intended to raise awareness about the actions that we need to improve the air quality on the planet. Because really, air pollution is a global problem. It's not just in China, for instance, where we hear about it a lot, or in other industrialized countries. The UN, in fact, says that 92% of the world's population is exposed to dirty air, and that causes some 7 million premature deaths each year. So, you know, people develop respiratory problems, they develop cancers, they develop all sorts of illnesses from air pollution. And so, coupled with climate change, with the whole move to push for renewable energies because it's going to help the planet, renewable energies also give us cleaner air. And so this is a very good way to highlight that.
What kind of influence do you think the UN has when it comes to issues about the climate? There is the Paris Accord, but it also has to do with countries willing and able to join and also do something about it.
There's a big climate conference coming up in November. That's going to be in Scotland. It's referred to as COP26. It's a review conference for the Paris Climate Accord, which you mentioned, which was signed in 2015. And the big concern about the Paris Climate Accord is that it didn't go far enough, that countries agreed to take measures to cut their greenhouse gas emissions, but experts are saying now, like you mentioned, with all these reports, that actually it doesn't go quite far enough and that we need to be even more ambitious and do even more to cut greenhouse gas emissions, carbon emissions, so that the planet won't warm as quickly. So this Clean Air for Blue Skies Day is a great opportunity to put that out front and center and to remind people about the effects of carbon emissions. You know, one of the good things to come out of the COVID pandemic, if you can say that, one of the positive things about the lockdowns was that air quality around the world really improved because people were staying home. They weren't using their cars. They weren't flying on airplanes. So emissions really dropped quite a bit during those really long stretches of lockdowns that we saw in 2020. But the UN is saying we need to continue to maintain these sort of improvements in our air quality as we start to come out of our COVID hibernation.
That's VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir. A coalition of environmental groups on Tuesday called for this year's climate summit to be postponed, arguing that too little has been done to ensure the safety of participants from COVID-19. The Climate Action Network, which includes more than 1,500 international organizations, said there is a risk that many government delegates, civil society activists, and journalists from developing countries may be unable to attend because of travel restrictions. The UN climate conference, known as COP26, is scheduled for early November in Glasgow, Scotland. The British government, which is hosting the event, rejected calls for postponement, saying a recent scientific report shows it is urgent for leaders to tackle the issue without further delay. COP26 president-designate Alok Sharma said the conference had already been delayed a year because of the pandemic, but, quote, climate change has not taken time off, unquote. The European Union's climate monitoring services said Tuesday that average temperature across the continent this summer was the warmest on record. Koalas, rock wallabies, and the nightcap oak, a rare tree, are some of the iconic species to be protected under an historic zero extinction plan in the Australian state of New South Wales. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The New South Wales government Tuesday outlined a strategy to safeguard the survival of endangered plants and animals in the state's vast network of national parks, to address what Environment Minister Matt Keane said is the worst mammal extinction rate in the world. More than 90 endangered species at risk from feral pests, bushfires and climate change will be given greater legal protection. There are new safeguards for birds, frogs and reptiles, as well as rare trees, including the dwarf mountain pine. The species joined the Wollemi pine, known as a dinosaur tree because of its ancient heritage, which was declared New South Wales' first asset of intergenerational significance last year, after the 2019-20 Black Summer bushfires almost wiped out its few known sites in the wild. There'll also be a network of predator-free areas, and authorities will be able to mandate conservation and fire management plans to ensure plants and animals are protected. For some species, there's little time to waste. Some population groups of the brush-tailed rock wallaby in the Warrumbungle National Park have fallen to just 10 animals. Environmental groups have broadly welcomed the Zero Extinction Initiative. Rachel Lowry, the Chief Conservation Officer of the Australian branch of the international conservation organisation, the World Wildlife Fund, says it's a promising plan.
What I find really encouraging is that the zero extinction target, it's the type of principled target that we need that draws a line in the sand and says no more extinctions. Now, I'd love to see that being drawn actually for the whole nation and not just for species in protected areas, and in this case, species in protected areas in New South Wales only. But like I said, it's a good step forward.
It's not just an Australian problem. Officials in New South Wales have warned that globally, 1 million species face extinction in the coming decades. National Threatened Species Day is commemorated across Australia September 7 to raise awareness of plants and animals at risk of dying out. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is the Voice of America. Salah Abdeslam goes on trial Wednesday for the November 2015 attacks in Paris that killed 130 people and injured more than 1,000 others. 20 people in all face trial, accused of involvement in the deadliest attack ever in peacetime France. Abdeslam is the only one of those suspects of actually carrying out the attacks to be captured alive. On the evening of November 13, 2015, Paris was hit by gun and bomb attacks on the Bataclan Music Hall, six bars and restaurants, and the perimeter of the Stade de France Sports Stadium just outside the French capital. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the attacks. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Afo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. A Guinean army unit seized control of the country Sunday and announced it had deposed President Alpha Conde. The soldiers expressed frustration over widespread poverty and corruption in Guinea. Anita Hammarschlag spoke to political analysts about the coup and possible effects on West Africa in this report from Dakar, Senegal.
After Conde's first win in 2010, citizens hoped he would bring stability to Guinea, which had suffered decades of rampant corruption. It was the country's first democratic election since gaining independence from France in 1958. But critics say Conde's presidency has only increased poverty, despite the country's immense supply of mineral riches. Tensions peaked last year when the 83-year-old president changed the constitution to allow himself to seek a third term. After he won, violent demonstrations erupted across the country. David Zoumanou is a senior research consultant with the Institute of Security Studies in Dakar and Pretoria.
That really creates a tension. You have civil society organizations, you have other political forces contesting the decisions, contesting his elections, but the military was on his side, able to quell the demands of the people. So the ground was almost leveled for political stability to lead to what we are observing now in Guinea.
On Sunday, the dissenters within Conde's military criticized his actions and said they were taking matters into their own hands. They said a curfew would be imposed and the borders would be shut. While many civilians were seen celebrating the coup, international actors, including the U.S., France, and U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, condemned the seizure of power. Political analysts worry the events are representative of a larger trend. In recent years, countries throughout West Africa have witnessed a surge in unconstitutional third-term bids, as well as a rise in coups. Mali, for example, has been rattled by two coups in the last year, Zoumanou notes.
All that is due to the lack of commitment of leaders to the democratic principle. So if the governance is not adequately rooted in the will, expressed will of the people, unfortunately, we have to continue to deal with a military intrusion.
Zoumanou said such interventions are hardly conducive to a healthy democracy. Gidi Api is a political analyst and the founder of West Africa Citizen Think Tank. He says it gives the impression of a worrying political trajectory with the possibility of a return to military coups. But Yabi said it's important to note that Mali and Guinea were already in crisis mode. Other West African countries, particularly those who have stable democracies, won't necessarily follow the same path. Annika Hammarschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Somalia's president and prime minister were in a standoff Monday over the prime minister's suspension of the country's top spy chief. Mohamed Tahir reports from Mogadishu.
Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble announced Monday morning that he is suspending Fahd Yassin, the director of Somalia's National Intelligence and Security Agency. Roble said he was acting because Yassin had failed to deliver a report on the killing of one of the agency's spies, Ikran Talil Farah, who disappeared in June and was declared dead by NISA. A few hours later Monday, President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo rejected the Prime Minister's action, saying he has no constitutional mandate to suspend the spy chief and urged Yassin to continue in his role. Security analyst Samira Ahmed of Mogadishu-based Hiral Institute says it will be helpful for an outside party to intervene. She says there is a need for non-partisan mediators to end the escalating political difference between the two highest offices in the country. If that does not happen, she says there is a threat of division as the security forces will be obliged to choose between the conflicting orders. She says this will result in security threats to the country and the ongoing elections. The mother of slain officer, Ali Mahmoud, welcomed the Prime Minister's move to fire the spy chief and appealed to the President to support it. She urged the President not to obstruct justice for her alleged murdered daughter by blocking the Prime Minister's decision. She asked the head of state to put himself in her shoes as a parent seeking justice for her child. It's nothing new for Somali president and prime minister to be at odds over the powers of their respective offices. Musa Ahmed, a law expert at Somali National University, believes there is need for a clear separation of powers in the Somali draft constitution. He says the absence of the constitutional court has complicated the recurrent political difference between Somali president and his prime minister. He says the appointing powers of the two leaders in the constitution is also not clear. Therefore, he says there is a need for a new chapter in the draft constitution to make clear the powers of the two, especially during government transitional periods. The leaders of the opposition have welcomed the move by the prime minister to suspend the director of intelligence, saying it was long overdue. The director himself has not responded to the prime minister. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
New York City firefighter Thomas Alioto spent months helping searching for victim remains at Ground Zero after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He died in December 2019 from a 9/11-related illness. Nina Vishneva met with Alioto's widow and three daughters to talk about his heroism. Anna Rice narrates her story.
After the 9/11 terrorist attacks, Alioto worked for extended periods of time at Ground Zero, looking for the remains of the dead, breathing in toxic substances that took a toll on his health.
My husband had glass and pieces of black smoke and things in his lungs. And little by little, he was taken from us.
Doctors said he had 10 years at most. He lived for 18.
He was a fighter, but 9/11 never left him. 9/11 became him. He would do it all over again.
Alioto's three daughters have a hard time remembering that dreadful day. Amanda was 10, Ashley was 6, and Alyssa was only 4. Angela Alioto picked up the two older girls from school earlier than usual that day, but they didn't go home. They went to the neighbor's place. A lot of their neighbors also had family members who were firefighters.
All the moms were crying and watching it on TV. So once I started seeing the TV and the fire department, I had a feeling, you know, Daddy was there.
On the morning of 9/11, Thomas Alioto was heading home after a night shift. After he learned the first plane hit the tower, he turned around and went straight to what had been the World Trade Center. He almost died under the North Tower that was collapsing to the ground. It took him a few hours to free himself from the rubble. And then he just lost track of time. It was a blur, a desperate attempt to find survivors amid the wreckage, the debris, the giant metal beams.
He thought he was dead. I remember him telling me that he had no feeling. He thought something was biting him. I can't just explain it. He was bleeding inside his boots.
In 2006, due to health issues, Alioto had to leave his job. His only outlet now was his family.
We lived a little bit different than other children around us. They didn't really understand our dad came home. That was like your dad came home, that was it. But our dad didn't really come home as who he was. He was a completely different person after that.
Ashley and Amanda became teachers, like their mother. Alioto tried to convince Alyssa, the youngest of the three, to do the same, but she chose a career in the police force, and that made him extremely proud. Right before her graduation from the academy, Alyssa and some of her friends went to the National September 11th Memorial and Museum, a tradition New York policemen observe.
I sent him a helmet. He said, look for Mike Esposito, which was his best friend that he lost that day. He had sent me a picture, that exact picture. Said, I've been trying to find that. He said, can we spend some time together tonight? I said, yes. And that was December 17th, 2019 at 2 p.m. And that was the last time I spoke to him because later that night, lost his battle.
Everything in the house still reminds Angela and the girls about Alioto.
I can still like smell the smoke. It makes me feel like my dad's here.
It's the second 9/11 anniversary in the house that Alioto is not present at. A metal cross he found at Ground Zero, awards, his helmets. Alioto's daughters cherish everything that reminds them of their father. Alyssa's graduation picture has his face photoshopped on it. He died 6 days before the event. But in the picture, they are together. You can even hear his voice. A little recorder hidden in stuffed toys that still says the words his family heard so many times. For Nina Vishnova in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Powell-Dawson, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.